Now, this is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is October 14th, 1994. I'm with Ted Finman in his office in the law school, and we're going to talk about his career here at the UW. Before we get into the UW, let's begin at the beginning. Could you talk briefly about your childhood and your early years of schooling?
I was born in San Francisco on December 10, 1931, and raised there until I went off to college. Do you want more about pre-college, or?
Let's talk about any influences, how you started in your path.
Well, the one thing that I remember from early childhood as a significant event, sometime during grammar school, I had been a bad boy, so to speak, getting in trouble here and there. And a couple of my good friends in grammar school, which actually would have gone, I think, as I recall, through the eighth grade, so one would normally go through the eighth grade there and then off to high school. But a couple of my friends were going off to a junior high, which was a distance away, a bus trip away. And I decided that I would like to go with them and made the kind of conscious decision to change my life, to not get in trouble and so on. And I did go to the junior high and was a very good student and active in the debate squad and that sort of thing. Now that's, I guess, the one sort of vivid recollection from my childhood of making that decision to change somehow. Getting involved in debate and public speaking probably was a very important thing because that carried through the 3 years of junior high and then into high school, and I discovered that I was pretty good at that sort of thing.
What about your parents? Tell me a little bit about them. Were they college educated?
No, neither of my parents went to college. They were business people. They owned and operated a retail luggage store in San Francisco. And indeed, from the time that my head was above the counter, I actually went down to the store on weekends and helped out selling. I'm not sure what more there is to say about them that is particularly relevant. I was close to my mother, not particularly close to my father.
Did they stress education for you?
Education was just always presupposed. You know, it was in that respect, I suppose, a very typical Jewish family. You would go to college. There was just never any question about that matter.
So you were going to go to college, and you lived in San Francisco. How did you end up at the University of Chicago?
In high school, I was, I think, a little bored with high school. And there was a friend that I knew in high school who had found out about the University of Chicago's undergraduate program, and that the University of Chicago was taking people before they finished high school. Actually, at that time, they would take people after 2 years of high school, but also after three. That sounded very attractive to me, and although my friend didn't pursue this program, I did. I left Lowell High School after my junior year and went to the University of Chicago at a very tender age, I must say. So it seems from my present perspective.
What were your intentions? What did you plan on studying there?
Well, the University of Chicago at that time had a very set undergraduate program. There were really no electives. you'd go to the University of Chicago. They would give you a series of placement examinations that, in theory, found out what you knew. That then determined what you needed to know in order to earn their bachelor degree. And you could then get the degree by doing whatever coursework was required to learn what you didn't know, so that you could finish in a year, in theory, or even less, because there were no required number of credits. There was a required amount of background, of knowledge. I finished there in 3 years, which was pretty typical for someone coming there after 3 years of high school. It was a very general education, very good education, as I recall.
Were there any particular teachers or courses that stand out in your mind as being particularly important to you?
No, nothing really. The only thing I remember vividly is Spanish, because foreign language was really difficult for me. I was really phobic about foreign languages. I had my appendix out in high school early on in first year of Latin, and appendicitis at that time was 10 days, 2 weeks away from school, and that really set me back, and I never recovered until more contemporary times.
When you finished your training at the University of Chicago, when did you start developing an interest in law, or had that already been developing along the way?
That had developed before I finished undergraduate. I'm not sure whether the interest was there before I went to college. It could well have been. I kind of saw law as an entree to politics. That was the way the interest originated. And I knew I wanted to go to law school, if not before going to college, certainly early on during college. My wife and I were married in our last half year of college. She had come to the University of Chicago from New York. And originally, I was going to go to law school at the University of Chicago. I applied and was admitted there. But then we found out that Sue was pregnant. And we figured, since we ultimately wanted to go back to the West Coast anyway, it made a lot more sense to go back there for law school rather than stay in Chicago. So I applied to the University of California, Berkeley, and the University of California, Berkeley figured credits out this way. They said, well, you've had 3 years of high school, so we'll take the first year of college and allocate that to finishing high school. That leaves you with 2 years of college. That means you need two more years of undergraduate in order to get into law school. And that wasn't very attractive. Stanford at that time figured it the same way, but they were allowing people to do their last year of undergraduate as their, or their first year of law school as their last year of undergraduate. And that meant I only had to take one more year of undergraduate work in order to get into Stanford. And so I decided to go to Stanford Law School. I did that 1 year of undergraduate credits going to Berkeley on a Monday, Wednesday, Friday schedule, taking whatever courses looked attractive that were available on those days, because we were living in San Francisco. And actually, that was a very enjoyable year. I took courses in some areas that I'd placed out of at the University of Chicago, and so I hadn't taken courses there, but really their placement exams weren't that accurate, because I didn't know that much. And I do remember some things from that 1 year at Berkeley. I took a couple of courses in the Civil War, in U.S. history, from a professor by the name of Stamp, who was just wonderful. Mm-hmm. And I took a philosophy in a course. I can't remember the teacher's name, but he was a logical positivist, and that's what the course was about. And that was a real eye-opener for me. I think that had a good deal of influence.
In what sense was it an eye-opener?
You know, I can't pin it down. I just remember that it really started me thinking in different ways. And there was another course, which was an elementary course by a professor by the name of Tenbrook, who really was very well known. It was in the speech department, but it wasn't really a speech course. It was a course about thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And that also, I recall having a great impact on me, though I can't pin it down.
Mm-hmm. Before we go on to Stanford, for those people listening to this tape, you will occasionally be hearing noises in the background. There is construction going on in the law school, so that is the reason. What about Stanford? Was that a good choice? Did that turn out to be a good choice?
I can't compare it with anything else, but it was a wonderful experience for me. The law school really was a formative influence on me. I think law school has somewhat of an impact on most people who attend, in that it makes them see that problems are a lot more complicated than what they would have thought before. And it certainly did that for me. I formed fairly close relationships with three or four of the professors at Stanford. And I did very well from the beginning, so that I was one of a handful of students that, judging now how they would have reacted on the basis of how I react to students as a teacher,
mm-hmm.
I was probably one of a half a dozen students that they looked upon as up-and-comers, who would be assuming leading roles on the law review and so on. And it just, these relationships just developed. It's hard mm-hmm. to, you mm-hmm. can't pinpoint
right.
how, they just do.
Any particular professors that stand out in your mind as being influential in your own directions?
Oh, yeah, I think I can name three or four. There was Phil Neal, who later went to University of Chicago Law School and was dean there for a while. There was Keith Mann, who I think is still at Stanford. There's John Merriman, who was a legal writing instructor during my first year, and I really felt that I learned a great deal from him and developed a close relationship with him. There was Moffat Hancock, who, not someone I developed a close relationship with, and Moffat has since died, but he was a very innovative teacher and taught material that wasn't typical law school. In a couple of a seminar and a course, he was sort of avant-garde, at least for Stanford at that time. And Stanford at that time was fairly traditional. I suppose most schools really were at that time. Moffat was on the cutting edge, so to speak.
What kind of things did he teach that might have been considered avant-garde?
Oh, he taught the relationship between law and language, which would, you know, focus on the problems of language. We, in a seminar, we read Susan Langer. I can't quite remember the name of the
philosophy
book.
Philosophy in a New Key?
Yes, Philosophy in a New Key, exactly. And other things that were clearly off the beaten track for law school.
That's interesting.
I still remember Moffat saying to us in one course, and I say it sometimes to my students, that the most powerful legal argument in the world is, I never heard of such a thing.
At Stanford, we had a discussion several months ago about your background. You said that you were editor-in-chief of the Stanford Law Review. Wait one second. So how did it come to be that, come about that you became editor-in-chief? How was that selected?
Well, that the head of the Law Review was an elected position, and I ran for it with two of my classmates, and I won. The three of us became very good friends, and although we seldom see one another, remain so to this day.
Were you nominated by the professors to be among those final three?
No, law reviews are strictly student run. I was, in a sense, a traditional choice because I was first in the class academically, but the other two were close behind. There was an element of politics involved. One of the other three was what you would call a liberal, and that's the way I would have been characterized. The other one was very conservative. At least that's the way he would have been perceived. So there was that sort of a little bit of that element in the election.
And was the class, does that reflect the class as being more of a liberal class than?
I don't know how much that influenced the election, really. I don't know.
What does editor-in-chief of the Law Review do?
The editor-in-chief has the authority to appoint other people to managerial, editorial kinds of positions, and you know, ultimately to make all of the decisions having to do with the publication of the Law Review. You don't do that by yourself, obviously. You have someone who is in charge of reviewing articles that are submitted by faculty from your school and wherever else you can get, and soliciting articles from law faculty all over the country. That's the articles editor. There are traditionally two types of student pieces in law reviews, one relatively short, one longer. There are editors in charge of each of those areas, and then there's some flexibility in how you want to structure your management team, so to speak. There's also a managing editor who really doesn't have to do with editorial stuff, but other management kinds of problems. And I don't remember exactly what positions I used. I could check it easily enough, but I appointed these other two people who had run for president of the review to the other two top management positions, and in effect, we really were a triumvirate running the Law Review. Any problems that came up, I consulted with them, and we kind of reached collective decisions about what would be the best thing to do.
Did you enjoy this experience?
Oh, it was wonderful. Really was wonderful. The sense of camaraderie and accomplishment was just great.
Is that the kind of thing that helps you down the line, so to speak, in terms of the experience it gives you and the resume line it fills?
Well, it's certainly important on the resume. There's no question about that. Yeah, editor-in-chief or president, however it's called, of the Law Review, or any of the top positions are very important helps in one subsequent career. Certainly, I've learned a great deal on Law Review, both in my first year and then in the management role. It's an experience that is, I think, somewhat comparable to graduate school experience in writing a doctoral thesis, because you really write under very close supervision, not by faculty now, but by other students who are probably more critical than faculty would be. And you know, you write a piece and you go through several drafts with criticism both on substance and on writing form, and you learn just how much something can be improved by going over and over and over it again. And then you assume the role of supervisor over someone else's writing and learn it from that end too.
On your resume, you also noted that you were elected to, I hope I pronounced this right, the Order of the
Coif.
Coif.
Yeah.
What's that?
That's just an honorary society, and election is rather pro forma. It is virtually automatic with grades.
So, and then you graduated after how many years? 3 years?
3 years.
And you were number one in your class, is that
yeah.
correct? How did, what happened between there, and how did you end up at the University of New Mexico with your first job?
Well, sometime during law school, I decided that I'd like to have an academic career, but I decided to get some experience in practice first. And I also decided, which in retrospect I think was probably not the wisest decision, but I also decided that I didn't want to go with a large firm and be buried in the library, you know, the folklore about large firms. So I went with a small firm in San Jose, California that did primarily plaintiff's personal injury work. And I was there, I don't recall exactly how long, a year or so, not particularly happy with the work there, because the problem with small firms is, by and large, they don't feel that they have resources to allocate to training new people, so you're kind of on your own. And I also didn't think the work was very high quality, so I wasn't very satisfied. And then I got a call from Carl Spaeth, who was Dean of Stanford Law School. And I had been interested in free speech problems even well before law school. But Carl knew that I was interested in that area. And at that time, this was the period in which there were prosecutions under the Smith Act of the leadership of the U.S. Communist Party. And there had just recently been a series of prosecutions of so-called second-string leadership. including one in California covering the leadership of the California Party. And they'd been convicted, and that had been appealed to the Federal Court of Appeals, which had affirmed the convictions. And they were now going to seek review in the United States Supreme Court. And they had come to the California State Bar representing that they had difficulty finding lawyers who would represent them in the Supreme Court proceedings. And a man by the name of Mike Donovan, who was a member, as best I recall, of the Board of Governors of the State Bar at that time, had volunteered to participate in the Supreme Court proceedings. Well, Mike didn't know anything about First Amendment or free speech problems, but he was, brave is not an inappropriate word. He was brave enough to take it on. But then he called Carl and said, who can you recommend to help me on this? So Carl called me and asked if I'd be interested. And it came at just the right time because I wasn't particularly happy in the San Jose practice. And I said, sure. And for the next year and a half, something like that, I worked on that case, which in the books is known as Yates versus, either Yates versus U.S. or U.S. versus Yates, Yates being the name of one of the defendants in the case. And that was a great experience. It was a really tough job because there were volumes of material from the trial and the Court of Appeals proceedings to go through in order to write a what's called a petition for certiorari to the United States Supreme Court, in which you try and convince the court that this case is important enough for it to hear, because it has had complete discretion whether to hear the case or not. And the court granted certiorari, and then I wrote the brief on the merits for two of the defendants. There were, six, seven, eight defendants, something like that. I think this was true at the certiorari part of the proceeding too, that the job had been divided among a bunch of lawyers, some of whom would represent certain defendants and others representing other defendants. And we represented, that'll switch down. We represented the two defendants who were the editors of the People's Daily World, one in San Francisco, one in L.A., which was the semi-official newspaper of the California Communist Party. And so after certiorari was granted, I wrote the brief on behalf of them on the question of whether the evidence presented at trial was sufficient to allow a reasonable jury to find them guilty. And this was first of all a question on which the Supreme Court seldom grants certiorari. It ordinarily will hear only questions of law rather than questions about the sufficiency of the evidence. So we were a little surprised and very pleased when the court granted cert not only on some major questions of law, but on this question of the sufficiency of the evidence. And the questions of law, which were common to all of the defendants, were handled by some other lawyers. And the question of sufficiency of the evidence was divided among the lawyers in terms of some lawyers handling some defendants and others. We ultimately won on that point, which was really quite unusual and remarkable and extremely satisfying. That was a great experience, too.
So you really got in both feet at you said earlier that they couldn't find lawyers to handle this. Was that because it was such a politically hot issue?
Oh, this was in the middle of the McCarthy period.
Did that fallout come on you or your group? Did you experience any problems because of
no,
that?
No, never hurt me. This was really towards the end of the McCarthy period. When were the Army McCarthy hearings? Do you remember?
54. Gee, I don't even, I'm embarrassed to say.
Yeah, I don't remember either. I was never hurt by this, and I don't think Mike Donovan was ever hurt by this.
Was it covered by the press a lot, or was this sort of a...
Are we okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't recall any particular press coverage. What I do recall is going back east with Mike when the case was to be argued. And we first went to, these are reminiscences, we first went to New York to confer with all of the lawyers who would be arguing before the Supreme Court. And we went to one of the World Series ball games in New York, I remember that. And then we went down to Washington and stayed in the Metropolitan Club. And then Mike argued the case, of course, but I was there in the court to hear the whole thing.
Well, that must have been exciting.
Yeah, it was, very.
So you finished your stint there. How long did it take?
About a year and a half.
So where were you going to go at this point?
Well, when that was toward the end of that, when I knew that was going to be over, I started looking for other regular law jobs in practice, and still focusing on a small law office rather than a large one, and took a job with another very small office in San Francisco that did general practice for relatively well-to-do people, just handling a whole array of whatever their problems might be, from traditional kinds of business problems and organizing businesses and doing estate planning and tax work and you name it. Mm-hmm. Their kids got in trouble handling that, everything. And then I did that for a few years. I don't recall just how many. And then sometime probably, it would have been in the winter or spring of 1959, Phil Neal, I think it was, called me and said that he'd heard about an opening that was going to be coming up at the University of New Mexico. And Vern Countryman, who had taught at Yale but then had left Yale and been in practice for a while, had been hired as dean at New Mexico. I got in touch with New Mexico and with Countryman, and I think probably Phil got in touch with them for me too, and went out and interviewed for that job, and they hired me, and that's how I got to New Mexico.
What were you hired to fill a specific position?
Yes. People usually are in law schools to some extent hired for to teach particular courses. And one of the courses I was hired to teach was civil procedure, which I've been teaching ever since. So that's from 1959 to the present. I also taught, as I recall, I taught evidence there, which I continued to teach when I first came here, but haven't taught for a long, long time.
3 years, and you spent a summer as a visiting professor at Stanford also.
Right.
What did you teach there?
I think I taught evidence at Stanford. I'm not quite sure, but I think that's what I taught that summer.
From there, you ended up
at Rutgers.
At Rutgers in New Jersey. How did that long trip come about?
Well, it went from New Mexico to Rutgers rather
right,
than
New Mexico to Rutgers.
New Mexico was okay as a place to start, but for one thing, we weren't particularly enamored with Albuquerque, and my wife wasn't particularly happy in Albuquerque. And in any event, I wanted to move on. I had career aspirations, and I got an offer from New Mexico, from Rutgers, to come visit there for a year. I don't recall how that came about, but I got that offer and went there, and I was teaching civil procedure there, and they needed someone to teach their debtors and creditors rights course, which was a course I'd never taken, leave alone taught, didn't know anything about, but that was an area in which Vern Countryman had expertise and had indeed published a case book, a teaching book. So I went there with Vern's notes, teaching notes, and his case book, and got through that and taught the procedure course. They invited me to stay on permanently. And I certainly would have chosen that over New Mexico and was prepared to make that decision. And I went to the law school meetings, which would have been the end of December, first part of January, right at that point, and that would have been December 1960, December 62, January 63, just for the socializing of it, really, to see friends and so on, because I had this offer from Rutgers and that looked good. And I ran into Stuart McCauley, who had been a close friend both in law school and my family and Stuart's family. That is, Stuart and his wife, and Sue and I had been good friends as well. Stuart was 1 year behind me in law school, and he remembers my editing his work both with joy and chagrin, I think. In any event, I ran into Stuart, and we were just talking about things, and he said, well, you know, we're looking for a couple of people. Why don't you come talk to our hiring committee? And so, completely relaxed about the whole thing, because I had a job, I went and talked to them, and they invited me to come out here to talk further with the faculty, and ultimately offered me a job. And this, that looked like a better prospect than Rutgers. Wisconsin A was a better school with a better reputation. And Rutgers Newark was really a commuting school. No one hardly lived in Newark. And so the faculty lived sprinkled around New Jersey and in Manhattan. It wasn't, from our point of view, a particularly attractive place to raise a family. Still a lot of anti-Semitism and separation in the East. When we went to visit there and were looking for a place to stay for the year, we were in a kindly fashion advised by the dean at Rutgers not to look in certain areas. Yeah. And the block where we did find a house, one side of the block that we lived was virtually all Jewish, and on the other side, virtually all Gentile. And we took a little heat from our Jewish neighbors because our kids were friendly with some of the Gentile neighbors. I mean, it was That's the way it was. And Madison looked like a very nice place to raise a family. So we took the job here and came out here. Came out here to look for housing in the spring of 1963 and then moved out in the early summer.
You said that Wisconsin had a better reputation than Rutgers. Could you characterize Wisconsin's reputation as you remember it being at the time?
Well, I think probably Willard Hurst was the person with a national and, I guess, international reputation for looking at law from a social perspective and doing legal history. There were other well-known people, Jake Boischer, who would have been of Willard's generation, was quite well-known. Frank Remington, who was, a generation younger than Willard, had become, or certainly was becoming, quite well-known. And the school's reputation was for doing a lot of research and writing in the law and society area as opposed to the more traditional legal writing. I mean, there was a lot of traditional stuff going on as well, but Wisconsin was a school in the forefront of law and society work.
And that's something that appealed to you?
Yeah. It had indeed been a kind of tradition in a more limited way perhaps, but still a tradition at Stanford Law Review, where we did student pieces that delved deeply into the factual setting of problems and didn't do, I mean, we did certainly a fair amount, because it was an important part of training, of doctrinal analysis. But we broadened out way beyond that in our student work.
And what were you hired to teach, to come to Wisconsin and teach?
Civil procedure. And evidence, initially.
I remember us talking about this last time. tell me a little bit about civil procedure, when it's taught in the student's curriculum, the perspective on it from the student's perspective, and why you have enjoyed it so much over the years.
Well, first of all, civil procedure deals with the problems that arise in the processing of civil lawsuits, civil being distinguished from criminal. And people generally would suppose that this is a sort of mechanical kind of thing, teaching people technical rules about doing things that are sort of cut and dried. And as in any area of law or life, there are a lot of mechanical things that need to be done and are dry and uninteresting. But as any lawyer would know, there are lots of complex, difficult procedures, difficult problems in civil procedure that implicate important social problems that underlie the legal problems. So it's interesting from that point of view. It's a course which is almost invariably given in a student's first year of law school, and very often, as here, as it was at New Mexico and Rutgers, and I think most law schools, at least part of the civil procedure offering is given in the very first semester of law school. It's probably the most difficult course for first-year law students, because unlike a course in contracts or torts or criminal law, where although they've had no formal training, they understand the underlying social problems. And people know what crime is. People know why society has an interest in having law about these matters. They know, although they may not realize that they know, some important underlying aspects of contract law. They know that it's important for people to be able to rely on the promises that other people make. A deal is a deal. Mm-hmm. And so they have some understanding at an elementary level, albeit, of the social phenomena and problems that underlie the legal structure. And that's critical. If you don't mm-hmm. understand that, you can't understand the rules of law. They don't make any sense at all. They don't have the same comprehension in the civil procedure area. They have to learn why it is that we have rules about this matter, why anybody gives a damn. And that makes it much more difficult. So that's a real challenge. But I don't know that I always did this. I can't remember back to the first few years. But for as long as I can remember, I have always used the civil procedure course as a way of teaching students basic lessons and principles about legal analysis, which is probably the most important thing they learn in law school anyway. Because the information they learn, while it's important, is for the most part at a fairly elementary level. The actual problems they'll have to deal with in practice require them to gain more detailed information than they're likely to have obtained in law school. The background information is very important for understanding the more complex and esoteric questions that will come up in practice, but it's the basic understanding of analysis that is really crucial.
You've taught this since New Mexico. Yeah. Is that unusual in law schools? Does someone usually handle this job, or is it something that's passed on generally?
Oh, it's not unusual. There are other people here at our law school who have been teaching the same course since they came. Yeah. I mean, you invest a lot in a course, so there's a strong incentive to continue teaching it. There are also incentives to branch out and do something different.
Now, in a course like this, you just talked about one way that you said you weren't sure if you did this the first few years, but you do it now. Has this course evolved along with the law? I don't know if that's exactly how to say it.
Well, there have been some changes as the law has changed, and there have been some important changes, but except for some very recent changes, nothing I think that one would characterize as really radical changes in the law. So that the content of the course, of the information, doesn't change that much over the years. I mean, as some rules change, you teach the new version and compare it with the old. You don't continue to teach the old. But really, the problems that are being addressed by the law haven't changed. It's just that there's a variation in the way the law addresses the problem. There have been some related changes that one could spend a lot of time teaching about, and some teachers place or use more time on them than I do. Alternative dispute resolution has been a big area for some time, using dispute resolution methods like mediation and so on, rather than judicial proceedings. I've elected not to make that a part of my course because I have enough trouble with the time I have covering what I want to cover.
You mentioned that you also taught a course in evidence when you came. Could you tell me
about that? For a few years, as well as a seminar on some evidence problems. And I was also, for a while, teaching an advanced course in civil procedure, which covered problems not dealt with in the basic course. And somewhere in that period, I was also getting into teaching the professional responsibilities course, perhaps better known as legal ethics, and it all didn't fit together. There wasn't time to do it all. So the evidence course dropped out.
And you wrote a text on legal ethics, didn't you?
That started at New Mexico because this Vern Countryman decided that he was going to do a teaching book. It's not really a text. It's a collection of materials with textual notes and so on, but with cases and other materials. Anyway, Vern decided that he was going to get into this area and do a case book and asked me if I would like to do it with him. I decided, yes, I would. So we started the project at New Mexico and did a kind of paperback collection of materials, which was voluminous. And this was actually, as I recall, Vern got a grant from, I don't know, some outfit to do this, because there wasn't anything in the field except a quite old book. It was not a big area at the time, not a required course at all, not taught everywhere, not a requirement at most law schools. So there wasn't a great incentive to do teaching materials. Wasn't a big market for it. But Vern got this grant, and we did this collection of materials, and then we got a contract from Little Brown to do a casebook for Little Brown. And we finished this casebook after I had come here. And it was the first modern casebook in the area. So there was a big market for it. And then the profession began to take a greater interest in the whole field, and eventually the course became a required course, and there now are many, many case books. Our, together with a colleague here, Ted Schneer, who's now at the University of Arizona Law School, Ted Schneer and I, with Vern, but Vern did very, very little. We did a second edition of the case book, and that lasted for quite a while, but that's now out of print. So it was the first book, but it's no longer in use.
Now, you said that the course became more popular. What about the times or about the legal profession, whatever, made it so this course became more popular?
Yes.
Watergate,
exactly.
Really?
Exactly. Well, that's when the lawyers became notorious for being bad and engaging in outrageous conduct, and that was a stimulus to the profession's concern about the whole thing.
We're going to go into a little bit later on about your work with medical and bioethics development at the law school, so we will come back to this. But moving on to your other courses, you mentioned that you also taught a course or a seminar in free speech.
Yes, for a good many years I taught a seminar in political free speech problems. As I said before, I had been interested in free speech problems for a long, long time, dating back indeed to law school days, if not before. And this seminar, I think, arose out of the Vietnam protest area, at least my interest in teaching such a seminar. The impetus for such a seminar came out of the problems that were arising from the anti-war protest movement, as did the article that Stuart McCauley and I did, and so on.
What specifically about the anti-war movement brought up free speech?
Well, those of us who were concerned with free speech problems were concerned about the... I don't know how long we'll be able to do this.
They seem like they're getting closer here.
They're remodeling the floor immediately above right now. Anyway, we were concerned...
Ignore it.
...that there would be repressive governmental actions against legitimate free speech activity. And at least in the first years of the anti-war movement, most of the protest was perfectly legitimate and protected by the First Amendment. But that, of course, hadn't stopped government officials in the McCarthy period, and we were concerned about that. And you know, that's what led to the article that Stuart and I did.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
In terms of the free speech thing, did you then talk to the dean and have a course organized on that, around, based on your experiences or based on what you perceive might be happening?
Well, the article was a discussion of what was happening. Okay. The article that Stuart and I did. The course was really an academic course, mm-hmm. Exploring the problems, using, in part, using the Vietnam era problems as the context in which to explore them, but also using this problems that had arisen in the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. as a context in which to explore them.
Was this course well received by students? I mean, was there an interest in it?
Oh yeah, it was. There were always more people wanting to take it than I would let in, because I wanted it to be a real seminar to really think about, mm-hmm. The problems, and I limited it to about 12 to 15 people, and I organized it in a way that was different than most seminars. Instead of having people write a term paper, I had them write a series of brief papers, which would be almost every week and would be directed to the readings that we were going to be considering that week and to questions that I had prepared on those, mm-hmm. readings, which turned out to be a really pedagogically a great, mm-hmm. device, because it meant that people had to be much better prepared than they would ordinarily, mm-hmm. be, even though this was a select group of students, self-selected because they were interested in the topic. Nonetheless, you have to think a lot more about something if you've got to put it on paper, even if you think you're thinking hard before you put it on paper. Well, so this really meant that the people had thought quite a bit about it.
Let's move into the Vietnam protest for a second, and your own involvement, or whatever, however you would characterize it, in it. How involved were you in that whole initial protest movement?
Initially, I was not. I had been very involved in politics as an undergraduate at University of Chicago. I had decided when I went into academic life that I was really going to be an academic. I got sidetracked at New Mexico because there, you know, that was still the McCarthy period, and there was at the state level a real attack on free speech and academic freedom by a member of the state legislature. And now, wait a minute. Let me think. Gee, I'm sorry. My recollection, I think I'm mixing up. Yeah, there was something of this sort during college days, but also at New Mexico, and I got involved in that somewhat. But then when I came here, I came here with the intention of really just focusing on academic life and not getting involved in either national political matters or campus matters. But I guess I am what I am. And at least, in the first period of the war and protests, I was not involved. And I think what got me involved was the Dow demonstration up in Commerce in, I think it was October 1967. One of my law students here, who was a very good student, and a student of mine by the name of Larry Silver, who, as I say, had developed a relationship with me like I had with some of my professors in law school, went up to Dow to observe what was going on and came running back reporting, on what I think most of us would say, even in retrospect, was rather outrageous behavior by the sheriff's deputies at that time. And that got me involved. And it got me involved not in terms of the merits of the war, but in terms of really of free speech issues, because although I think that that protest had gone over the line of protected activity insofar as it impaired free access and free movement in commerce itself, was not protected. You know, the police reaction, the sheriff's reaction, was brutal, and so I got involved with some others in protesting that and in organizing a protest of that, which led to one and maybe two all-faculty meetings in the Union Theater, and so on.
Now, what we're talking about for people listening is the Dow demonstrations were because Dow was recruiting people here, and the student protesters blocked the doorway. Was that it?
Yeah, student protesters filled the halls, and certainly the design of some of the people involved in the student protest would have been to disrupt the interviews, because Dow was a leading manufacturer of napalm and so on. I suspect a good many of the student protesters just wanted to protest, but not to dramatically protest, but not to disrupt the interviews. But that's what it was all about.
And Dow, in many ways, again, for people listening, sort of became a symbol of corporate of corporate America at its worst. Did you actually get involved? You actually participated in protests then, as well as organizing them or working?
Well, I participated in organizing the faculty meetings.
Okay. What about the rest of the law school? It was a tough time. I mean, it was kind of hard to sit on your hands on the sidelines because it was there was so much going on campus. What about your colleagues in the law school? How did?
Well, eventually, I became much more involved in the anti-war movement itself, as distinct from just the where I was at first, which was to try and protect free speech activities, which were anti-war protests. But eventually I became active in opposing the war. Some of my other colleagues also became involved, and there were others who became involved on the other side, and then there were yet others who were outraged by student attempts to disrupt academic life and block the entrances to the law school or disrupt classes here or elsewhere. And I too was outraged, although I was at that time involved in protesting the war. I was outraged and opposed those anti-war activities which went beyond the line of legitimate free speech as I saw it and as the law would have seen it, into disrupting classrooms and teaching activities.
What about the law students themselves? Were they a fairly active group in this?
There was an active group within the law school.
Did this spill over into the classroom at all, or was it pretty much?
A little bit. Not nearly as much as elsewhere on campus, but a little bit. I don't recall anyone ever seeking to take over my class. Mm-hmm. People would ask to make announcements just prior to class. And that wasn't
about meetings and rallies.
Yeah,
and,
right. That was never a problem for me. Yeah. I wouldn't let them use classroom time, and I never used classroom time to express anti-war sentiments.
Well, one more question on the Vietnam thing. You said that you helped organize these faculty meetings at the Union Theater. What happened in these meetings? What was the result of?
Give you my best recollection, which is a little bit hazy. The purpose of the meeting was to inform the faculty more broadly about what had happened in Commerce, and B, to get some sort of resolution or action opposing the use of force by the sheriff's department. And of course there was controversy about what happened in Commerce. There were, as always in these situations, different stories about what happened. I think that we had some visual material. I think some movies, or would there have been videotape at that time? I don't remember. But I think there was some material of that sort that we wanted to have shown. This was a very controversial meeting because the social democratic left on campus, which would have been, you know, old line socialists, old line labor, socialist labor unionists, people who came out of that movement, and also old-line Trotskyists, who from in the 30s and 40s and continuing on into the 50s and 60s and even the 70s represented one part of the left, and the other, an opposing part, was the communist left, or as the first part would have characterized it, the Stalinist left. The what I'll call the social democratic left, I think, perceived the anti-war movement as being virtually synonymous with the Stalinist left. Mm. And the Stalinist left was there, to be sure. But that's a misperception, because it was much, much broader. It included the New Left, SDS and so on, as well as a substantial segment of old-line liberals who believed as much in democratic values as the social democratic left, but were also opposed to the war, in addition to believing in democratic values. In any event, there was a lot of opposition at this meeting, as I recall it, from people on the social democratic left, not because they approved of the brutality of the sheriff's people, but you know, they were reacting to what they perceived as a movement from anti-democratic forces and so on. And they just didn't want to have any of it. So that was one kind of division. And then there were, of course, there was, of course, a division between people who supported the war and people who opposed the war. And there was a division between people who would have defined free speech in a much narrower way and really didn't want student protest of any sort on campus. I don't recall what the ultimate outcome of the meeting was.
That's a good job of characterizing just how complex those times actually were. And in a way, you said that you were characterizing the reputation of Wisconsin in terms of law and society. Probably this is one of the better examples. As you said, free speech, a lot of that whole drive came out of this initial movement. Well, we managed to take a fairly long, although I think very profitable, tangent there into the Vietnam War. We were going to cover it later on. We had been talking about your courses, and we'd mentioned, your civil procedures, evidence, legal ethics.
Do you want to finish up the Vietnam stuff while we're on it? While we're on it?
Sure. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I know that the interview schedule asked about Faculty for Peace and other things.
Oh, yes, Faculty for Peace. Exactly. Yeah, I forgot all about that.
Faculty for Peace may well have emerged out of the aftermath of the Dow incident. I don't really recall when it emerged. It was an effort to create an entity on campus representing various segments of faculty opinion, all of which were opposed to the war. And I recall having an active role in the formation of Faculty for Peace, along with a very good friend, Ed Feige, who's in the economics department. And Ed and I had been very much concerned at the time of the Dow incident and jointly involved in organizing the meeting at the Union Theater, and remained very much involved thereafter. We were close friends and political allies, and coming from the same place politically, opposed to the war, but very much committed to democratic values. In any event, we and others were active in organizing Faculty for Peace, which covered the various political perspectives within the anti-war movement, you know, from the far left through the traditional liberal. And that made Faculty for Peace an uneasy organization, because within the organization there were disagreements on what constituted legitimate protest and appropriate tactics and so on. And Maurice Zeitlin, who was in the sociology department at that time, later moved to California, and toward whom I felt at a personal level, you know, some deep feelings of affection, whose politics were not mine. We had Maurice on one side, and Ed and I and others on the other side had some big battles about what Faculty for Peace could properly do. One important division was what it was proper to try and get the university as an institution to do. Maurice and others wanted the Faculty Senate or the Faculty, even before the Senate, the Faculty as an official institution to take a position on the merits of the war. Others of us strongly believed that we shouldn't do that, that it was fine for us as faculty, as individuals who were also faculty members, to use our whatever power we had to oppose the war, and that it was fine for Faculty for Peace as an organization composed of individuals who happened to be faculty members but did not represent the faculty as such or the university as such. It was fine for Faculty for Peace to take a position, but the university as an institution and the faculty as an official institution should maintain a neutral position on all this. There was big. There were big battles about this. Ultimately, we organized Faculty for Peace, organized a broad meeting of the faculty, which was held out at the Cow Palace, what we called the Cow Palace, mm-hmm. Out there on the Ag campus.
We'll call it the Cow Palace.
Yeah, it was a huge meeting. The place was full. And it passed an anti-war resolution, as I remember. But it was structured not as an official act of the faculty, but as an act of a large number of faculty who had gotten together under the auspices of Faculty for Peace. And we had a big battle with Maurice over that, and I think Maurice, there were battles up to the very last minute, some very sharp disagreements. Maurice was not above being disingenuous in promises about what he would and wouldn't do in order to accomplish his objectives.
So Faculty for Peace more or less was a way of bringing the faculty together to discuss these issues and to
plan protests, and you take actions that we could take against the war, and to plan teach-ins and the various possible activities to oppose the war.
What do you remember? Do you remember the day that Stirling Hall got bombed?
Sue and I were on an airplane coming home from somewhere when we heard about that. I wasn't here when it happened. I think we came in either later that day or the next day.
Did that event, in your mind, change or alter in any way the campus environment?
Oh, I think it did, yeah. The fact that someone was killed really shook up a tremendous number of people. I think what it did is change people's minds about what kind of protest activity they would support or tolerate. Mm-hmm. It didn't change people's minds about whether they supported or opposed the war. But I think that what it did was undercut whatever tolerance there would have been for peaceful but unlawful protest, disrupting classes, blockading classrooms, and so on.
Yeah, I've heard many people refer to it as the beginning of the end in many ways of the protest movement on campus, but
I think that overstates it, because after all, what was the date of Sterling Hall? The war itself was going away.
Yeah, 9/11, yeah. So the two went hand in hand.
Yeah.
We're going to go back to your teaching for a moment. You said there was one other course you wanted to mention.
I have for a long, long time, Moffat Hancock, back in law school days, sparked my interest in relationships between the language problems and law, and they're intimately related because, after all, legal reasoning involves the use of language. And a couple of times I taught a course under the title of legal process. A lot of different, quite different courses go under that same title. But I taught it a couple of times, focusing on the problems of law and language. I think I only taught it two times. One time I taught it jointly with my colleague Ted Schneer, who had similar interests, and another time I taught it jointly with Cliff Thompson while he was dean, and he also had similar interests. I haven't kept up teaching in that area simply because you can't do everything. And ultimately, much more of that became incorporated into the civil procedure course, so I satisfy my interest that way.
Hmm. Yeah, we still have a little time. Let's turn now to begin to talk about research. I think we'll just open it up today, and then we'll move into it a little more next time. Let's talk about the nature of research at the law school. When you came, what kind of research basically, can you characterize the kind of research that was basically going on here?
Yeah, there was a fair amount of different, though not unrelated, kinds of research. First of all, there's doctrinal research, which focuses on judicial decisions and analyzing the meaning of judicial decisions and lines of judicial decisions and what they all add up to, but doesn't go much beyond the doctrinal material as the base for its analysis. There was certainly some of that going on here. There was a great deal of what I've earlier referred to as law and society work, which is an effort to see the development of law as a part of social development and to relate other developments going on in society to the way law is developing. That kind of work has a lot of subparts. Legal history is certainly one part of that. Taking legal doctrine, which is dealing with certain social problems, and delving deeply into the factual aspects of those problems for the purpose of asking whether the legal doctrine makes sense is another part of it, and that part of it, Stewart and I and people at Stanford Law School had been doing ever since there. But there was a great deal of that kind of work going on here.
What kind of funding support did the law school have?
Ford Foundation was providing some funding for the law and society work. There was, of course, the graduate school funding, which was available throughout the university, but on a limited basis, on a competitive basis. The law school itself had quite limited funds to make available for research. And a major change in the time I've been here has been in the amount of research that the law school itself supports. We now have, in different ways, a sizable chunk of money to support the research of faculty, especially the research of younger faculty.
Now, you mentioned that last time, that there's special pockets of money set aside for them. Is this increase in research funding at Wisconsin during the years you've been here, does this compare with what has happened to other schools, or is this unique to Madison's situation?
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what's going on at other schools in this regard. I would suspect that there are some other schools, some private, but perhaps some public as well, that have developed at an earlier point in their history more substantial independent financial bases than what we earlier had here, and that some of that is allocated to research, but I don't know how much, and I can't really make a comparison.
What about your own research? How has that developed over time? Or
well, it was much more so in the earlier part of my career. I don't know how much detail you want.
Well, just an overview of the types of research you've been involved with.
I did some writing while I was still in practice, before I even got an academic position. That was, you know, in response to specific requests. One was for a review of interestingly, a civil procedure, multi-volume text on California civil procedure. Which I reviewed rather scathingly, and as I on occasion look back at it, to my chagrin, because it was just too unkind. And another piece I wrote in response to a request from a law review. And those were really doctrinal kinds of pieces. And then the first thing I did after I got into law school was really in the tradition that I had learned in the law review at Stanford, taking a legal problem but relating it to the not simply to analyzing cases, but to taking the underlying problems that the law was addressing. Mm-hmm. This was a civil procedure problem, taking a particular procedural device. And I looked at what it was supposed to do, what job it was supposed to do, and all of the cases that had decided various questions relating to this procedure. And it was apparent to me that the cases were just way off the mark, that they didn't understand what the function of this device was. And I wrote a very long piece analyzing this and then making a series of recommendations for changes in the law that specified how this device worked, so as to overcome both the mistakes that I thought had been made in the cases, and to modify the language of the statute itself to make the device more suited to its job. That was published in Yale Law Review, and indeed became the model for revisions that were made in this. It's a federal rule of civil procedure, not technically a statute, but my piece became the model for a whole bunch of changes that were made in the rule within 2 or 3 years after the piece was published. I did another piece which was really quite doctrinally focused on an evidence problem. Stuart and I did this piece on the anti-war protests, which was not at all doctrinally focused, not in terms of legal doctrine, because the question that interested us and that we addressed in the article was this: how are various governmental officials responding to anti-war protests? And are their responses consistent with the principles and values that underlie the First Amendment? There wasn't any really legal issue in the sense that there weren't any legal constraints on what government officials tried to do. There would be constraints on, they could take actions which would violate the First Amendment, but there wasn't any law that could punish them for trying to do this. So the question was, were they trying to counter the protests in ways that were consistent with free speech values? Or were they behaving in a way that violated free speech values?
Were you posing that question, or were you giving some answers to it, too?
Well, we did both.
What did you come up with?
Our conclusion was that, for the most part, their responses were quite legitimate, that they were respecting free speech values at the same time that they were in trying to counter the protests themselves. And it was quite an amazing contrast with the immediately preceding era in which government had acted against what it thought was a threat, namely the communist movement, where government officials, McCarthy was hardly the only one, but where many government officials had responded in a way that showed no respect whatever for free speech values, and that indeed posed a very serious threat to those values.